you're listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the U.S. Senate voted to end the use of force authorization that opened the door for the Iraq War in 2002. We'll find out how the law has been used over the last two decades and what, if anything, it would mean if it ends up actually being repealed. Now, like brats, cheese, and beer, the Friday night fish fry is a big Wisconsin food tradition, especially this time of year. Supper clubs will soon be filling up today with eager patrons sipping old fashions and hungry for some fish, potatoes, a little coleslaw, a side of tartar sauce, maybe some bread and butter. For this Good Friday edition of Food Friday, we're helping you recreate the fish fry experience in your own kitchen. Our guide is a classically trained chef, a 2020 James Beard Award semifinalist, and Madison Magazine's 2023 Chef of the Year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make fish fry at home? Want to hear you tell us about it, how it works for you? And if you have a favorite place to go for fish fry, past or present, we want to hear about it. You can name names, a supper club, a restaurant, a church basement. Share your favorite fish fry. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Farr is the owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are expanding next door to that restaurant in Monona. I understand the menu of the new place is going to include some fish fry. As a restaurant chef, how do you approach the fish fry, this thing that's really popular here in Wisconsin and a lot of people are going to have opinions on?
Well, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I opened up Mint Mark, I knew that fish fry was such an important part of the culture in Wisconsin, having grown up here, that I knew that I would be missing out on customers and Friday night business if I didn't throw my hat in the ring. So I take fish fry very seriously. And really, for a number of years, the team and I pushed so hard to try and create the best fish fry we possibly could in Madison. And I think we did a really great job.
What, you don't need to tell me your secrets exactly, but what is it that makes the fish in particular good when you're serving it up?
Well, the fish, for one, needs to come from within an area that's touching the state, I believe, you know, somewhere from the Great Lakes. So all of those little fish like the bluegill, the perch, those are the prime fish to look for. Atlantic cod is great. It's a great fish fry option, but at the end of the day, lake fish, I really feel, are the way to hit, especially walleye too. That's a great one. But the secret is really within the batter. You want something that's going to hold up and stay crispy and have that, you know, that super crunch when you bite into it, all at the same time, not obscuring the subtleties of the white flaky fish that our Great Lakes provide.
Now, not everybody's going to try to make the fish itself at home, but if we do want to, kind of, what's the bare minimum level of equipment we need?
Well, I, for one, would never try to do it inside because your house is going to smell like I do when I come home from work on Friday. So when I get tasked with this about once a year at my in-laws' cottage, typically, you know, somebody has given them a mess of perch or bluegill, even some walleye, maybe some pike once in a while. And it's up to me to fry for 15 to 20 people. I set up a turkey fryer with a shallow pot, or like what we call a rondo in the restaurant industry. And I fill that up with fryer oil, your canola oil, and I try to fry outside. I certainly, one of the things that I think we do really well at Mint Mark, and we'll be doing really well at Hank's, our new fish fry and burger joint, is the crispy batter. It's got to be light. It can't be weighted down with flour. So the way I go about that is I tend to think of it as more of a tempura, but instead of water, using beer and using rice flour instead of AP flour. So that within its own kind of sets you up for success. It's how far you want to go with seasoning, sometimes garlic powder, onion powder, what kind of beer you want to use. I prefer hams or something cheap and pungent, so it carries through. But really, if you set yourself up outside and get your fryer set to about 350 degrees and make a batter that you feel isn't like super cakey and thick, I think you're already winning.
I think the biggest mistake I make when I batter fry things is I'm not known for being a real patient guy. and I want to get stuff into the oil, and I do it before it's heated to that consistent temperature. I know what happens. What happens then when we don't have hot enough batter?
You're going super French at that point with your low temperature and your confit, which is, you know, reserved for duck legs and pork bellies and that sort of thing. You got to get it hot and fast.
Okay. And now spicing in the batter. Now I worry you're going to taste salt and pepper and stuff like that. If I'm getting all subtle with spices, but it's getting deep fried. Am I just like burning those spices out of the picture? Am I wasting my time and money putting those in?
No, I really don't believe so. I mean, we use a certain amount of garlic powder and onion powder in our batter. We also, you know, put a certain amount of salt. I think the salt actually, although very important to have in the batter so everything kind of tastes seasoned throughout, really shows up mostly on the outside, kind of like a French fry as well. But I don't think it's super lost. At the same time, you don't want to get wild and start throwing like caraway or, you know, like allspice in there and getting weird. I mean, we're in Wisconsin. We got to keep it real, you know?
Talking to Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison, the Muska Lounge in Monona, soon to be Hank's in Monona as well. Talking about fish fry, making fish fry at home and or the side dishes at home. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried making fish fry at home? What is the secret to a good fish fry, whether it's at home or at a restaurant? Do you have a favorite place to go for fish fry in your community? And are you going somewhere tonight? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, Sean, we got the fish. We got to have something to dip it in. You say you're a big fan of making our own tartar sauce at home. What goes into that?
Correct. We chose the restaurant, we make everything from scratch. That's a bit of a daunting task for somebody to take on at home. You know, cutting your own French fries, blanching them, and then frying them a second time. Shredding your own cabbage. So, you know, I suggest buying, you know, the frozen French fries, maybe some coleslaw dressing to make your own, like the coleslaw that way. But the tartar sauce, at the end of the day, the tartar sauce is what that fish goes into. And it's the thing you're always like, hey, excuse me, can I get another side of tartar sauce? So for me, it's important to keep it light because the idea of dipping something in straight mayonnaise can sound a little gross sometimes. So the way we do that is through acid and fresh herbs. At Mint Mark, we use a ton of lemon juice and lemon zest. We use chives, tarragon, parsley, and much to fishfryguy.com's chagrin, we use fresh dill in there as well, and capers and shallots and pickles. So all of those things get mixed up and chopped up really hard and folded into mayonnaise. And with all that herbage and lemon juice, it becomes really light and really savory. And really just a great like palate cleanser on the tongue, which nobody really says about tartar sauce, but I would put that on anything.
Okay, the thing that baffled me out of all that is somebody's complaining about dill in their tartar sauce. Like, I think dill is good with fish, right? Dill's good with lemon. What? Who?
I mean,
what, why?
You know, science has shown that dill goes well with fish.
Yeah, okay. I don't understand what that complaint would be. Now, when you do that thing for your in-laws and you're doing the fish fry, what is the range of sides you have along with? You got the fish, obviously, you got the tartar sauce. In your home presentation of a fish fry, what do you got to have?
In my home presentation of a fish fry, I like to see the coleslaw. I like to see the French fries. I like to see Aunt Renee's baked beans that she makes with like all the brown sugar and ground beef that goes into it. That seems to be in a crock pot every time we're there. You know, and then at the, you know, more importantly, the biggest ingredient is just having all the friends and family around to help eat it and enjoy it with. I mean, the entire goal of the Wisconsin fish fry is to go out and celebrate, you know, in a, you know, like a blue collar sense. You worked all week long and you finally get to go to the supper club or the tavern. You know, if it were up to me, I'd go to Chico's Villa Tap. And you get that first old fashioned and maybe the second one, and you wait for your table and you catch up with people over the week and you finally get to relax. So I think at the end of the day, the most important side is the company you keep and the fish fry that you eat.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jacob is with us in Burlington. Jacob, hi.
Hi. We recently got into air frying and I love doing seasoned fish in the air fryer and things, but getting breading on in the air fryer. I'm not having a whole lot of luck either getting it very brown or getting it to stick to the fish. And, you know, they recommend flipping it halfway through the air fry. Does your guest have any experience with that or recommendations?
Huh. Can it be done, do you think, Sean, getting the batter to stay on the fish in the air fryer?
I don't believe a fish fry with a wet batter can be achieved in an air fryer. However, I do know that if you have taken fish fry home from wherever you've eaten it in a to-go container, the next day it does refresh really well in an air fryer. But unfortunately, wet batters such as a beer batter for a fish fry need to be completely submerged in oil to kind of help encapsulate it around the fish.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Nina joins us now in Menasha. Nina, hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment that when we come up to Wisconsin on vacation, we don't have fish fries in Arizona. But I used to love to go to the VFW. They made the best. And I love the elderly veterans and their wives and stuff that used to work there. It's closed down here now. But one other thing I wanted to comment, the chef that's on now is, I had worked in a restaurant, and I'm just curious to, you know, we need to have some kind of, I don't know, regulation, because I went out for fish fry recently, and I got served tilapia, and they were trying to tell me it's haddock.
Uh-oh. Nina, thanks for the call. All right, to her first point, Sean, you were talking about the company and, you know, the tradition of, you know, supper clubs and restaurants, of course, but like VFWs and church basements during Lent, that is another great part of the fish fry tradition.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the best fish fries I've had were from my hometown in New London, Wisconsin, from the VFW. Once in a while, the Catholic Church would put one on. And, you know, and there was a campground where, you know, it was all elderly ladies that were doing the fish fry. And I'll be darned, they're some of the best that I've ever had and some of the most memorable fish fries for sure.
And then Nina brought up her concerns about fraudulent fish in the fish fry. Have you ever run into that anywhere?
There are there's some people out there that, you know, that just aren't ethical when it comes to what they're serving. But, you know, I think the places that really hold this tradition near and dear to their heart and want to celebrate it wouldn't be doing something like that. But I have certainly heard of those types of things in the past.
Nina, thanks a lot for that call and for visiting us from Arizona. We're talking to Sean Farr on this edition of Food Friday. Sean's the owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. He's our guest for this edition of Food Friday. He's helping us recreate the Friday night fish fry from home, whether we're making our own fish or just the sides along the way, and his love of the fish fry tradition in Wisconsin, even if, as most of us do, we go elsewhere to eat it. Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a secret to a great fried fish, a great coleslaw, good potatoes to go with fish? Let us know at 800-642-1234 and tell us your favorite place to go out to for a good fish fry. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison and the Muska Lounge in Monona. He's helping us create a Friday night fish fry in our own kitchen and some appreciation tips when we go out for fish fry as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what goes into making good fish for fish fry or all the sides or a secret of your own you want to share or a favorite place to go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Matt.
Hey, great show. I always love talking about food.
Me too.
Favorite place in Green Bay is Merrick's Bar. They've been around for 100 years, it seems. They've just got always a consistent, standard, very lightly battered or breaded type of fish. The second comment is that I've got a recipe for the easiest tartar sauce in the universe.
All right.
Basically, it boils down to mayonnaise as the base, and then pickle relish, but you need to get like the Heinz dill pickle relish. A few tablespoons of that in the sauce with some onion powder, and you've got the most amazing and simple tartar sauce to make.
Matt, thanks for the call. What do you think of that quick tartar sauce hack, Sean?
I mean, it's got the dill in it, right? Mm-hmm. You can't go wrong.
Exactly. Matt, thanks a lot for sharing it. Now, and he mentioned in Green Bay that's a 100-plus-year-old tavern serving the fish fry. And that's pretty cool that we have places in Wisconsin that have been at this for decades. You're hoping, I imagine, to replicate some of that experience, Sean.
Absolutely. I mean, if I could have an establishment for 100 years, that would be absolutely amazing.
Matt, thanks for the call. Jim joins us now in Green Bay. Jim, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I have a similar story, but I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and the Lake Erie perch and walleye is pretty famous. And we would go out, catch a couple hundred perch, bring them in, fillet them, and then my mom would cook them up. She would use a egg wash and then coat them in saltine cracker crumbs, mm-hmm. and then fry them up. And it was a very she would grind them up like powder.
The saltines.
And it was a very light batter. And it had a little salt in it already from the saltines. And it was, we would sit there and just eat till we passed out. with all the, and that was in the day when there were no limits. And we caught them and we, you know, fry them up fresh and go back out the next weekend.
Jim,
we also had
I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. I appreciate sharing that experience. That's about as fresh as fish is going to get, Sean. And your rule of the fish in your restaurant, your fish has to come from at least a state adjacent to Wisconsin and no further. Is that in part to get that fresh fish experience?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of what we deal with in the fish fry world is what we call IQF, or individually quick frozen, as well. There's no way I could pay for people to break down perch or bluegill all day long. I'm going to actually assume it was a Jim. His family might be a great person to hire, or a great team to hire to do that. But yeah, I always try and make sure it's coming from, you know, as local as possible, just so it's, you know, it's not sitting in some freezer across the pond and then, you know, getting shipped over and thawing and then getting frozen again. You know, you want to try and serve the highest quality product you possibly can.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that experience, and welcome to Wisconsin. I don't know how long you've been here from Cleveland. Talking to Sean Farr on Food Friday, head chef and owner of Mint Mark in Madison, Muska Lounge in Monona. Talking about the Friday fish fry, it's still time for you to join in if you call quick at 800-642-1234. We heard from Linda in Milwaukee, Sean. She couldn't stay on the line, but she wants to know about pan frying fish. Any advice on pan frying fish if we don't want to, you know, go to the effort of, you know, full on oil frying that fish?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an option. You want to make sure that you have a pan that's, you know, very high sided and it's not full to the brim, because when you do put fish in, you know, the steam gets released, or the water gets released from the fish, causing it to boil. So you want to make sure you're using a pretty high sided pan. Keeping the heat, making sure you're checking the temperature with a thermometer, keeping it around 350, 375, and then not overloading the pan, doing, you know, like five pieces at a time and maybe rotating them, you know.
And my fear always, Sean, when I'm doing stuff like pan fry fish, is that I'm going to overcook it. And that's often what I end up doing. So I don't make fish that often. How do I make sure, you know, it's cooked but not overcooked?
That's kind of the tricky part with the pan frying, because you most likely do have to flip it. So, you know, I would try and keep it about 2 minutes aside. A good rule of thumb is the GBD rule. If it's golden brown delicious, you're probably good to go.
Now let's talk potatoes. I don't want to leave those out. What are your favorite way to prepare potatoes to go with our fish fry?
So at Mint Mark, we do Chad Vogel's famous potato salad from a restaurant that has long been gone in Madison. He's my business partner in a lot of these ventures. So we do like a potato salad with a whole grain mustard and apple cider dressing. And then we also do French fries. We hand cut all of our French fries. They get blanched the morning of at about 275 degrees until the potatoes cook through. And then we wait until the service when they get fired off. We fry them at 375 and season them generously with salt. But I honestly feel like the French fry is the king of all the potatoes. I know there's a lot of people out there that like a good baked potato. But for me, it's another vehicle for tartar sauce, right?
Now, a lot of times, you know, especially the, like the church basement stuff, you get all this stuff and then you get the slice of white bread and some butter to go with it, like the little one pat of butter.
Yes.
Do you include some kind of bread when you're serving up a fish fry?
So I've always loved the weird bread side throughout my entire life that came with it, regardless if it's a Parker House roll, you know, and a little gold foil packet of butter that you kind of have to like hold in your hand until it's tempered. what we do is we get rye bread from Stalzi's Deli and Bakery. And we even go the extra step as to butter it for you.
Wow.
So we don't have to serve the butter chips. So, yeah, we take that extra step and, you know, my fancy restaurant, we spread that butter for you.
Fantastic. Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
That's Sean Farr, owner and head chef of Mint Mark in Madison, the Muska Lounge in Monona, and in the nearest future, Hank's in Monona. He joined us for Food Friday with advice on creating a great fish fry at home and the sides along with it, the tartar sauce, and great places to get some fish fry. You can keep informing us over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. What to you has to be included in a fish fry? How do you judge the quality of a fish fry, the fish, the sides, the whole shebang? And where do you like to go, especially this time of year when fish fry is particularly popular? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we had a couple few recommendations, maybe I'll share them on the show next week. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, visit Wisconsin medical clinics that offer free or low-cost care to people with limited access to health care. And you can join in, as always, with your questions, maybe even your own experiences. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week, charges for former President Trump, election news from Wisconsin, and a new NASA crew getting ready to head to the moon. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the U.S. Senate voted last week to repeal two authorizations for the use of military force in Iraq dating back to 1991 and 2002. The vote came 9 days after the 20th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War and Operation Iraqi Freedom. It represented significant bipartisan cooperation led by Democrat Tim Kaine of Virginia and Republican Todd Young of Indiana. President Biden has said he would sign the bill if it gets to his desk, but it's unclear how much support it's going to have in the House. There's another use of force authorization from 2001 that's been used in counterterrorism interventions around the world that remains untouched by the Senate bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the federal government officially repeal that military authorization in Iraq? Why or why not? What message, if any, do you think it would send if repealed? Do you have questions about how this works? What Congress authorizes the president to do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Hall is the Ambrose Heseltine Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at UW-Madison. He's a retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel with past assignments to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and U.S. Central Command, which oversees military operations in the Middle East. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. My pleasure to be here.
Can you talk about how this system works? We used to have, you know, a formal declaration of war that authorizes the executive branch, the president, to take military action. What, if anything, is different about this concept of a authorization of the use of force?
Yeah, well, of course, the United States has not formally declared war since 1942, the very early U.S. involvement in the Second World War. And since the conclusion of that conflict, you know, the world of armed conflict for the United States and the Soviet Union in a bipolar world was far more complicated and contested. And it saw the advent, not that this is historically novel, but novel from a U.S. perspective, a world of constabulary or police actions of the sort, such as the war in Korea. And that was the sort of euphemism used to describe that conflict. Truman actually sent U.S. forces into Korea without congressional authorization. Congress has, at various points in time since World War II, tried to assert its constitutional prerogative as being the power responsible for making decisions of war and peace. And it's done so by granting presidential administrations explicit authorizations to use military force in specific contexts. You mentioned the several of them that apply to recent operations in Iraq and the so-called global war on terror. I think probably the other most famous one since World War II is the Gulf of Tonkin resolution from 1964, which authorized the Johnson administration to respond to a real and an imagined attack, which ultimately launched U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
Now, the Senate action from, this is a couple weeks back now, tackled actually two authorizations, as I understand it, the 2002 one that led to the more recent Iraq War, and the 1991 resolution that was after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that they're still effectively in effect. Why are they in effect? Are they that open-ended?
Well, I suppose they are. I will admit that I myself was surprised to learn that the 1991 authorization had never been explicitly repealed or revoked. And so we might chalk that up to simple housekeeping. I think that the more significant, symbolically, but more than just symbolically, change here is the repealing of the 2002 authorization, which authorized the George W. Bush administration to launch what was later known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's not going to change anything on a day-to-day basis. So I don't know that there was a particular sense of urgency beyond the fact that we have, as you mentioned in the lead-in, marked the 20th anniversary of that campaign. And this is about time to clean up the books in that regard as well. We're no longer, and we have not been for quite some time now, conducting that kind of operation in Iraq, which was, you know, an operation conducted with the express purpose of deposing the Saddam Hussein regime and the Ba'ath Party. We haven't been engaged in that kind of operation for well over a decade now. And so the authorizations that have been revoked weren't actually in use. The one that remains in effect from 2001 that you mentioned is the one that more neatly matches ongoing U.S. and partner operations that continue to be conducted in Iraq.
I want to spend some time on that one, but I want to stay in Iraq for a moment. We had the Bush administration negotiating the effective U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. That happened under the Obama administration. Then ISIS came along and the U.S. Took military action in Iraq targeting ISIS. Was that in effect authorized by that 2002 resolution? The Obama administration didn't need to go back in effect to Congress and say, hey, we need to do some more stuff there now?
Well, presidential administrations and White House lawyers have a tendency of interpreting their authorizations rather broadly, and I think that's true of both parties. And I cannot speak specifically. I'm sure that the White House lawyers made a particular judgment on that question at the time. However, the fact is the 2001 authorization, which is basically authorization to wage a global war against violent extremism, fundamentalist, militant Islamic fundamentalism, that authorization more neatly fitted the circumstances of the reintroduction of USN partner forces in Iraq in 2014. And so with the repeal of the 2002 authorization and the 1991 authorization, it is that 2002 war on terror authorization that meets the circumstances and the requirements for both the Iraqi government and the foreign nation forces, which it has invited into its country to complete the defeat of ISIS.
Talking to John Hall, military historian at UW-Madison, looking at use of force authorizations provided by Congress to the White House over the years. The Senate voted to repeal two of them, the ones enabling two different wars against and in Iraq. But there's that still that big one out there, the in effect war on terror authorization. You could join in with your thoughts on that, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, that 2001 authorization, this Senate bill does not target that. I've seen some Republicans in the House saying that should be included too. There's been some criticism saying that it's a blank check in effect that allows presidents to intervene just about anywhere. What are your thoughts on that one that so far isn't on the table?
Well, you know, Rand Paul tried to issue an amendment in the Senate to the bill that repealed the 1991 and 2002 authorizations of military force to include also the 2001 authorization, and that went virtually nowhere. So there is no strong bipartisan support to revoke the 2001 authorization, because the unfortunate fact remains that there are still viable terrorist entities that are continuing to work to build the capacity and have the stated and demonstrated intent of attacking the United States and the homelands of the United States' allies. And so without that authorization, the Biden administration has no legal authority to continue to conduct or even to support operations designed to further attrit and ultimately defeat the likes of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, ISIS core in the Syria and Iraq, and ISIS Khorasan in the case of Afghanistan as well.
Is it, do you worry that it's too broad, though, that it could be used to justify a wide variety of actions that maybe Congress hadn't intended at the outset?
Well, in accordance with the War Powers Resolution of 1973, and granted, this is a fairly contentious resolution or piece of legislation by Congress, that was an effort by Congress to rein in the Nixon administration, which was famously described as the imperial presidency in the later years of the Vietnam War. And it essentially asserted exactly what the Constitution had asserted in terms of this division of authority between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and provides, I think, a reminder to administrations that these are our decisions to make. And not only do we have the power to authorize the use of military force, but we further have the power to deauthorize it, or specifically tell an administration that's enough of those military operations and you have a set period of time to redeploy military forces and cease these operations. That's never really been tested. And there are different legal scholars and different scholars of civil military relations and constitutional scholars who continue to debate this. I'm certainly no expert in any of those debates, but as a historian of the early republic, I do lean toward the Congressional War Powers prerogative in that debate. As I said before, White House counsels tend to take a more capacious view of presidential war-making powers. The specific point of departure in those debates is how broadly you might read a president's authority to repel a sudden attack or what a president perceives to be an imminent attack. In the age of sail and black powder, that was pretty straightforward. In the age of intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine launched ballistic missiles, not to mention now the militarization of space and cyberspace, what constitutes an imminent attack on the United States or a warranted and proportional response? That is a very meddlesome sort of question. And I don't think the 2001 authorization to continue active operations to defeat Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terrorist groups is anywhere near the level of importance of that much broader question about a president's prerogative to repel sudden attack with all of the means that adversaries of the United States have at their disposal in the 21st century.
We're talking to UW-Madison military history professor John Hall about the Iraq War and the recent U.S. Senate vote that would repeal the authorization of military force in that country. That particular vote may be symbolic. That change might be symbolic if it passed the House and got signed by the president. Also, the 2001 authorization that authorizes much of the war on terror. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much power do you think a president of the United States should have to use military force abroad? Do you want to see a more active role from Congress, or do you like the current state of affairs? And we're going to look back at changing attitudes toward the Iraq War. Have your attitudes changed over time? Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with John Hall, the Ambrose Heseltine Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at UW-Madison, retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel, with us today to talk about the Iraq War and the U.S. Senate voting to repeal the authorization for the use of military force in that country just after the 20th anniversary of the start of that war. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you looked back on that history with the 20th anniversary? Have your thoughts changed on why it happened, why the U.S. intervened in Iraq? What questions do you have for our guest about how presidential and congressional authority work in all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Drew is with us in Fitchburg. Drew, hello.
Hello. One thing that has always troubled me about presidential war powers is that there is an added incentive to go to war because it polls well. It's more easy to get reelected for a wartime president. They get to look strong, and that is something that Congress doesn't always provide a good check against.
Drew, thanks for the call. I've heard that sometimes, John, but I think of George H.W. Bush and the 91 Gulf War. And then his approval shot right up, and then he lost re-election. Do you have thoughts on the political impact of being a wartime president?
Yeah, no, I think the observation is generally correct in terms of George H.W. Bush, you know, dwindling in popularity. There's an old saying in American politics, I believe, it's the economy stupid, and President George H.W. Bush's reputation as a wartime heroic president couldn't compensate for economic woes. And I think certainly to the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration of a great illustration of Drew's point, and that is when Johnson asked for the what proved to be the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, he did so knowing it was an opportunity for him to look tough. He was a New Deal Democrat that wanted to push forward his Great Society legislation. He could not afford to look weak on communism. So this was an opportunity for him to rattle the saber. And his popularity skyrocketed in the wake of that. And he won that war power authorization from Congress with a rather overwhelming vote. Mm. The same is true in the wake of 9/11. I think that those are different circumstances. You know, what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin in August of 1964 is sort of a sad and sorry tale of misperception leading to escalation, whereas there is absolutely no mistake about what happened on September 11th. But I think there is a general trend in American history, and this is not unique to the United States, when there is a sudden attack on the United States, or in the case of Pearl Harbor, of course, there is the spirit of retribution, which extends across the electorate and is reflected among elected representatives as well, who are quick to authorize the use of military force in the search for justice. But then there's a cooling down period, and wars don't always go the way that they are intended to go, and that enthusiasm wanes. It's interesting to me that the vote for the authorization for use of military force that was just revoked, that was a far more contentious vote, because the decision to invade Iraq was made rather coolly. It was a calculated decision, and it was the subject of much debate at the time. And it was a very, very close vote. And so this is another reason why I think 20 years later, there is a desire to clean up the authorizations and to repeal that authorization, is it is now the general consensus of both the political leaders of this country, as well as I think, you know, informed citizens and historians, that that war was a great, tragic mistake. Repealing the authorization to launch it doesn't erase that unfortunate history, but at least helps to symbolically close that chapter.
Thanks for that call, Drew, at 800-642-1234. And John, I wanted to talk to you about the changing perception of the Iraq War with the anniversary. People were posting poll results from that time. Now, as you say, there was not by no means universal support. There were protests against the war. But in most demographic groups, there was at least majority support for it. And that seems to have changed a lot. I've seen some polls saying that veterans, even Iraq War veterans in some polls, oppose that war now more than they support it in hindsight. Can you talk about that big change over the last 20 years and how we think about the Iraq War?
Yeah, I don't think you have to look at the entirety of the 20 years for that change to have taken place. I recall watching Colin Powell's Bravura performance before the UN Security Council on live television, and myself buying the case hook, line, and sinker, thinking this is beyond any kind of reasonable doubt. Case for weapons of mass destruction is strong. There's a clear and present danger. And I don't know that I came over to being wholly on board with the decision to invade Iraq at the time. Point of fact, I can recall that I was not, but I at least found the argument for doing so compelling at that time. And of course, we soon thereafter discovered that there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no ongoing campaign being covered up. And Colin Powell himself later regretted that performance and considered it quite justifiably as a stain on a legacy, a lifetime of service to the country.
Do you think we've learned lessons about how and when to go to war based on that experience?
Yes, but if there's one thing that I'm afraid I learned from studying U.S. military history in its full breadth and depth, it's that generations learn lessons, and different generations then have to relearn those lessons. And oftentimes those lessons are too black and white and too simplistic, and it leads to constrained choices the next time an actual crisis confronts the United States, because there are these apparently indisputable truths. History shows that this is the case. For instance, at the end of World War I and the interwar period, history shows us we should not have done that again. And that led to what I would call deliberate unpreparedness for the next challenge that arose. And I think it led to the unnecessary loss of life. So, yes, it does impart wisdom, but it's not the wisdom of a historian, not to sound too proud of my discipline's expertise on any matters. But that's my concern about lessons learned from chapters such as this, is that they're appropriate for a generation at a moment, but there are oftentimes misapplied to different circumstances.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. Been my pleasure. Have a great day.
That's John Hall, Associate Professor of U.S. Military History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel with past assignments to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and U.S. Central Command, which oversees military operations in the Middle East. We've been looking back at the Iraq War and the use of force authorizations that the U.S. Senate just voted to end with regards to Iraq, what they mean, what it doesn't mean, what changes and what doesn't if that ends up going to the president's desk and getting signed. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Wisconsin voters passed two constitutional amendments last week related to bail for people who are awaiting trial. We'll find out what impact those changes could have. And a new report takes a close look at health here in Wisconsin, and it does it one county at a time. Find out where Wisconsin is doing well, both geographically and in the causes of good or poor health, and where there's room for improvement. And as always, you can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.